and welcome to the AfroReads podcast with your hosts,
Amara
and Ugochi.
AfroReads is a book review podcast that was created out of our shared love for reading African fiction books.
We talk through its themes and try to tie its key messages to our African heritage, culture, and contemporary issues.
We invite you to turn the page and let's begin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of AfroReads Podcast. You're here with Ugochi and Amra, your hosts for this episode. And we are joined by a special guest. His name is Eric Mugendi. Eric, welcome, and thank you for coming on our podcast.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself before we start?
Okay, so as you've said, my name is Eric Mugendi. I live and work in Nairobi in Kenya, and I'm a program manager with a technology in journalism startup. And yeah, so I read a lot. So this was a really fantastic opportunity to actually read something on purpose so that I could talk about it. Yeah. And I think the main thing I'm looking forward to is just trying to dig through this book. And then also, yeah, I'm really a big fan of African literature. And yeah, so I'm also a big fan of the podcast, I would say.
Awesome. Well, thank you for joining us. So we have a few icebreaker questions for you before we get started. So they're rapid questions. So are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm gonna ask you four questions. What is your favorite Kenyan dish?
It would be chapati, which is like a flatbread, and beans.
Okay. How many siblings do you have?
I have one, a younger brother.
Younger brother, nice. Favorite Kenyan destination that brings you peace?
I would say Lamu, which is a really fantastic town at the coast.
Okay. And so it's International Women's Month this month. Who inspires you?
I would say Wangari Maathai. So she was actually the reason why I took the course I did in uni, which was environmental studies. And just the fact that she triumphed over adversity in some really fantastic ways, like championing the cause for women and for the environment as well, to the point where she even got recognition by getting a Nobel Prize. Yeah.
Nice.
Funny enough, she was an international women's person for this month. So that's a coincidence. Are you sure you didn't check her Instagram handle? I mean, the flattery.
It was... Let me just say I did my research.
Yeah. We thought her story was really like inspiring as well. Like how many women get to, first of all, get the Nobel Peace Prize, the Nobel Prize, but also like be quite formidable in the environmental field as well. So is she still alive, right?
No, she died, unfortunately, in 2011. So this is like 10 years since. And the other, actually, I think earlier this month was Wangari Maathai Day. So that was another, like basically to commemorate the work that she did, a lot of people are like taking up her cause, they're planting trees. So it's really good to see that her legacy is still being maintained and held up, yeah.
You said something about adversity. I know she faced a lot of backlash, but mainly, again, reading it as an outsider, it was just mainly, people were just not used to the environment talks. But the fact you said adversity, what's the story there?
So one of the things that happened to her was she got divorced from her husband. And, because of that, because she was trying to fight for the cause of women in Kenya. And one of the things that she kept doing was she would eventually get, she attracted the attention of the government And the government at the time was really like pushing for this one park in the middle of Nairobi to be turned into like a building complex.
Yeah, I read
Yeah, so she actually organized for another, for a bunch of women who were like the mothers of political detainees to go to this one part of the park, which is now called Freedom Corner, where they were literally like attacked and beaten. And so she suffered a lot of physical violence. And then also like in the process of her getting her divorce from her husband, her name was basically dragged through the mud. She literally was taking on this really big system, which had a lot of entrenched like violence. And she eventually like got the recognition from elsewhere, from outside, before she could get recognized in Kenya. So
yeah, that was, it's always like that.
Yeah.
A prophet is not, something like that, is not recognized in his own household or his own surroundings. He has to always seek it from outside. Okay. Yeah, thank you for sharing that with us. It's very important. And to think of the fact that this is also Mother's Day, and just thinking of what you said about her name being dragged through the mud for, again, like a female issue, which is, you know, blaming the woman when things like that happen, like divorce and stuff. That's very interesting. But yeah, moving on to current events. Ugochi, tell us like the very important news you heard this week.
Yeah, so I watched the YouTube clip of the president of Ghana. He was at a conference in Switzerland with the president of Switzerland. So she first gave her speech, and she, you know, she mentioned, we need raw materials from Ghana. From time, we've had a great relationship with Ghana. We've created work both in Switzerland and in Ghana. So just all the positive things, you know. And then the president comes up and he starts also piggybacking and saying, you know, the missionaries came to Ghana. They've been good to me. They've been good to my family. We've benefited from Swiss relations, and over the years it's gotten stronger. But now we are interested in stopping the exportation of cocoa, and we want to create our own chocolate, create our own jobs from this, build our economy. So I thought it was interesting because the looks on the faces of these Swiss, I guess, dignitaries are just like, oh, wow, this is a bold move.
Yeah, Eric, what do you think of that?
Yeah, I think it's really important for African leaders to like take a much more active role in making sure that the stuff that's going out of their countries is being used to the best or like to empower the citizens. So like we've seen in this instance, like Swiss companies, I think Nestle is one of them. They basically take raw materials from Africa and then they process them and then they sell them back to us for a really serious markup. And then you have countries like Switzerland and Belgium and all these other places which do not grow any cocoa, but then like they have some of the biggest like chocolate like producing factories and chocolate manufacturing. And it's a kind of like sustained kind of violence, I'd say. Just the way capitalism has led us to a situation where we are essentially just sending out our resources for cheap because then unprocessed, and then they go out and then there's such a huge like markup. And then to the point where I think there was a documentary I saw once where there was a documentary I did see where there's a farmer from Ivory Coast who was growing cocoa, but then he had never tasted chocolate. So we have very ironic situations where you're basically like the guy who takes the seeds and then puts them in the ground, and then they grow, and then you harvest them, and then you send them off, and you have no idea what comes out of the stuff that you're growing. But because we are so like we are so disadvantaged in some of these things because of the historic injustices, which have essentially denied us access to our own raw materials, and then to the point where the type of exploitation that we're seeing gets like actively sustained by these corporations and by these by the trade agreements that we've also tried to get into. So the like African countries end up getting like the short end of the stick. And I completely agree with what the president of Ghana says, where he's essentially pointing out that we're not going to just sit back and be disadvantaged like this. And we're not going to, because we keep finding ourselves in situations where we're literally playing, we're literally taking a back seat in the running of our own countries. Yeah. So I completely agree that it's about time that we looked at these agreements and that we essentially rewrote them so that they're fairer and we're not actively sustaining some of these things which were put in place by like people who were like actively maintaining, like it's almost like a parasitic arrangement. Like
yeah,
we are sustaining them, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, me and Ugochi, we've talked so many times about the structural adjustment programs. This was typical, you know. Mm. And as you said, they sell the raw materials for cheap. In fact, if you think of cheap, it's even cheaper because so many farmers are doing the same cultivation of cocoa. So the prices can never really go up to any level because it's influenced by the world prices and it's influenced by the fact that there's too much supply. So again, they constantly remain poor. Someone like the Swiss government, with all the relations they have with Ghana, they give aid. No one has said, let's try and make this more sustainable. Let's build infrastructure to kind of see where this happens. Okay, I don't know a lot about their relationship, but, you know, just why aid? Why can't you say, let's do more fair trading? Let's actually see what we can do so that you can, why haven't they suggested like, let's do this, let's try and see if you can make your own chocolate? That's real aid when it's sustainable, you know. And yeah, it's you have to call it what it is, a parasitic relationship. But I wonder, as the devil's advocate, I was discussing with Ugochi like yesterday, like we've heard these talks before. I was telling Ugochi, if it's one thing I know African leaders are good at, is being eloquent in seeing the problems and just, you know, talking about it in a very smooth and very emotional and empathetic. At the end of the speeches, you're just like, oh my God. The problem is that I don't know, I don't see the action. Like, fine, this speech was made this week, but I have promised Ugochi that I am going to follow up in 2 years, in 5 years, in 10 years. I want to see where this goes to. Because I was telling her that, yes, he's giving a passionate speech, but I would like to know who paid for his trip to Switzerland or whatever. Mm. Did the Swiss government pay for his trip? Like, is he just saying this to be good? Or is the Swiss government going to be like, come on, we paid for your trip and everything. How far? How was that? Or are they going to say, okay, this is a good passionate speech, let's go back to how things were, please. And is it like, I'm going to follow this up because it's a good speech. Everybody clapped. I saw the comments on YouTube, but just playing devil's advocate, we've heard it all before. Like, so it should just be interesting how this plays out. Anyway, enough about current events. Ugochi, I'm going to take it back to you to say any final words about any of the current events and then tell us more about the book we are talking about today.
It's just a lot of things are going on. But in terms of Ghana, and I think I've seen progress over the years with them. So I'm going to try to be optimistic, but I hear what you're saying. We have to follow it up and hopefully they follow through. So let's move on to the book. We read Dust by Yvonne Adhiambo Owor. The book is centered on the death of Odidi Oganda, who was killed by the police in Nairobi, Kenya, during the 2007 election riots. I'm not sure if it was that night that he was killed when the riots started, but his killing didn't have to do with the riot itself. After that, we were introduced to his family, who reunited over his death. And then we grow to understand the transgenerational violence in Kenya that has carried on and affected the whole family. So the book makes reference to the Mau Mau uprising, which occurred during 1952 to 1960, makes reference of Kenyan independence, and then also the 2007 election riots.
All right, thank you, Ugochi. Yes, before we wanted to explain the themes of the book, we just wanted to give a brief history about the different time periods you talked about, starting from the Mau Mau riots or revolution.
Yeah, the Mama Uprising.
Uprising.
So it began in 1952. Eric, if you want to jump in at any time, because I know that you know more about it.
So actually, 1952 is when the state of emergency was declared in response to the attacks by Mau Mau. And a lot of members of the movement were like former soldiers who'd gone to fight in the Second World War. So they'd gone and then they came back. And then one of the main motivations was that they went to these theaters of war where they saw like white men dying, and that bleeding, essentially dying. Revealed to them the mortality of the colonialists, because previously they weren't like a lot of these movements tended to be much more political, so they weren't there were some incidents of violence, but then the Mau Mau movement was more coordinated. And in response to that, the British essentially sent in troops to go and find the main leaders of the Mau Mau. So a lot of them were captured and they were taken to camps where they were tortured really brutally. And as a result, like there's a lot of... actually, one of the things that happened as a result of the Mau Mau uprising is some of the survivors actually sued the British government for the torture that they suffered. And so it was it was a really dark period, I'd say, in Kenya, because members of certain ethnic groups, in this case, because a lot of the members of Mau Mau came from the Kikuyu and a couple of other associated tribes. So there was essentially like a series of lockdowns where members of these tribes who were living in Nairobi were being arrested, and they were being taken to these camps which were out of town. And the other thing that happened during that time was there was also like oath taking. So basically, in order to become a member, you needed to take a certain oath. And then they tried, or the government at the time tried to find the people who were administering these oaths, because it was a very elaborate process. Like to this day, like, we don't really know exactly what was happening during the taking of these oaths, because one of the main things as part of the oath was a code of silence. And then the thing that happened as a result of the Mau Mau uprising was there was a lot of like displacement of tribes as well. So people were being taken away from where they lived into these areas called protected villages, which were essentially like cut off, like you're completely like fenced in, and then like they dig a moat. So, and then the African men were required to carry this thing called a kipande, which is like a pass, which essentially required you to get permission to go like out of your village, or even to go into Nairobi, or even to go anywhere really. So there was restriction of this freedom of movement, and there was also a lot of like torture and violence, and like there's a lot of like that kind of trauma that sort of carried into post-independence Kenya, because the state of emergency ended, I think, in 1960, and at the time there was a lot of political activity had been banned. But I think with time, the British and the colonial government came to realize that they weren't really going to like quell this movement. So they started making concessions, like giving Africans the right to representation in the Legislative Council. So they'd have like certain seats designated for Europeans and Asians, and then they introduced Africans as well. And it was a very big radical movement, because it kind of inspired other Africans in other parts of the world, like some of people who were members of the Black Panthers in the US actually got inspiration from the Mau Mau. And ironically, the government that came in after independence wasn't really like composed of the people who fought, like the Mau Mau. It tended to be more collaborators. So the oppression sort of extended into independence and post-independence. So they never really got the stuff that they were fighting for, because they were fighting for land and they're fighting for their rights to be recognized. But which tribe
ruled out? So you said the power was handed over at independence, and Kikuyu were the ones that fought. So is it Luo?
It was still a Kikuyu.
But just first
president was Kikuyu.
Yeah,
and he had a cabinet that came from lots of different parts of the country, but at the same time, like, there wasn't that much representation from. So essentially, the structure that the colonialists had established, which is like you have district commissioners and provincial commissioners, and all the way down, that structure was maintained, and the people who were there before independence, so these are people who had been appointed by the colonialists, they kept their positions and they became really powerful after independence. So they were essentially shortchanged. They put their lives at risk. They went into hiding, they went into the forests and the caves to attack the British. Mm-hmm. And they tended to focus in, there were like these parts of Kenya we call the White Highlands, which are kind of reserved. Okay. For Europeans, so that's where a lot of the activity was focused. But it wasn't like the Mamao didn't just have Kikuyu members, because it also had a lot of
Embu,
and
Embu someone
and
else.
Meru, and, Meru. And other. There were also other sort of independence movements in other parts of the country as well.
Okay, so it was less about tribe and more about the people that fought were just not even put in the government in the first place.
Yeah.
I asked about tribe because I think in Nigeria it was a bit different. It was more on the lines of tribe. Yeah, and there's just so many questions to ask, but I think the one thing that stood out to me, as you said, were the way the executions happened and the torturing. Oh my God, but one thing outstanding was like they said Barack's father, Hussein Obama, was also part of the Mau Mau uprising, and he was also tortured and everything, which was quite interesting. And I think leading on, because we were going to talk about independence, and when did Kenya achieve its independence?
That was in 1963.
1963, but it's interesting that you talk about the Oath of Silence. I didn't even know it came from the Mau Mau uprising, but it's ironic that was now used on its own people, that the Kikuyu and the people that were in charge. You've just explained to me that these were different sets of people, but that Oath of Silence and everything was now used to oppress Kenyans in like a different way. It was almost like Animal Farm, where everybody was fighting to remove, like, you know, the human beings. But when the animals started ruling, it was even worse. But it was worse, but it's you people killing your own animals, like it's animals killing animals as opposed to human beings being the oppressor.
Yeah.
So that was just very interesting. And I got that a lot in dust.
The book actually says, I'm not sure who says it in the book, but they say words became silent. Independence game. So there's even a word, nyakua.
So nyakua is to snatch.
To snatch.
Like to grab, yeah, in Swahili.
Okay. And so then in the book it said that it was cleansed. That word was cleansed to mean hard work. So I sort of understood it, but I was hoping to ask you if you could expand on that a little bit more.
Right. So I think the way it was used in the book was sort of referring to land and how land was like forcibly acquired. And for the colonialists, what they did was they took the best pieces of land or the best parts of the country, and then they moved the tribes that lived there into these protected villages, which are essentially like reservations. And so that culture of just going in and taking land and moving the people who lived there to smaller and less fertile parts of the country, it was sustained and it still, it happened like quite often, where you'd find that, especially during the first Kenyatta presidency, where essentially what the British did was they gave the government land to buy, they gave the government money to buy back land from the colonialists who were leaving. And what they did was, they used the money the government got to buy land for themselves.
For themselves, yeah, they said that in the book.
Yeah.
Or did they? Or did have we been speaking to Eric too much that he said it? I don't know. I read it somewhere. But yeah, it's very interesting. Like, but I this is a very out of box question, and I've come across a lot of British people that still live in Kenya. So are you indirectly trying to tell me that there are still British people that occupy these very kind of controversial areas where, so how are you as like a normal Kenyan going around your business? How do you see that? Like, I know there's a place called Karen. I don't know if that's part of the reserved areas for like, and you know, having like colonial connotations, do you guys just see it as, well, that's part of history, that's part of life? Or is there still some kind of, you know, conversation that is not being had, like it, and I said had, sorry, had, like an elephant in the room.
So Karen is actually like one of the more posh parts of Nairobi, where like you can legitimately be just driving down a road and then you see someone on horseback. And then a lot of the houses there are, tend to be like really big and then on really large pieces of land. So that's also kind of like ostentatious as well. And I think just the conversation a lot of people have been having more recently is how the character of Karen is being lost, because like there's apartment buildings going up and just a lot of people are sort of moving in into these parts of Nairobi, which previously were like reserved for the very wealthy. So I think it's changed now from like a race thing, like a colonial.
Okay. Just more if you can class. So if you more you can afford it. Okay. I always just wondered about that. Yeah. So another interesting fact is, so we were supposed to be talking about independence, and you've just said that Kenya got its independence in 1963. So Ugochi, did you want to talk a little bit about what we had for that?
Tom Mboya. So he's considered like the father of gaining Kenyan independence, right?
He's a key figure,
So I just wanted to talk a little bit about him. He was a trade unionist, educator, a Pan-Africanist, right? An author. Yeah. So I'm sure he was very threatening to this to this new government that came in place. But he made a lot of contributions towards getting Kenya to that place of independence. He was later assassinated July 5th, 1969.
Yeah.
So I brought this up because in the book, it said that Njenga assassinated him.
Yeah.
And then when they held Njenga for trial, I believe, where they questioned him, he said, why are you picking on me? Ask the big man. So immediately what came to mind, the big man, probably these, it didn't come to mind as the British. It came to mind that it's this new government who's, I guess, gonna perpetuate more chaos within the nation. Yeah. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
That's all I had to say about Tom Mboya. But he was also mentioned a lot in the book. And one of the main characters, Napier, said that when Tom Mboya died is when he lost faith for Kenya.
Yeah. And what was Tom Mboya's problem? Because he fought for independence, and then the fact he was assassinated in 1969 means that there was something amiss, because the independence he fought for was achieved. So
actually Mboya's story is quite interesting, because he was born in this part of central Kenya called Thika, and he actually spoke Kikuyu, which is the language of that part of Kenya, and but his family was from Rusinga, which is an island in Lake Victoria, which is in the west. So the way this Mboya was one of the main architects of this program called it was literally airlifting Kenyans to go study in the US. And that was one of the places. That's actually how Barack Hussein Obama ended up in the US and ended up fathering the future president.
Yeah.
And so the main I think the way he had worked was through trade unions, and he was able to sort of get a lot of action happening, a lot of radical action. And trade unionists were really important in the independence movement in Kenya, because I think it's the way, like, all of these people were from, like, very different backgrounds, but then they were united by the fact that they're all, like, one class. They were the working class. And then they were trying to agitate for their rights, and then indirectly for the rights of others who are also working or who are also, like, ordinary citizens. And at some level, like, he retained that streak of agitating for the rights of people.
Okay, yeah.
And he became, I think he was one of the main activists within the government of the first Kenyatta president.
Republic, yes.
Yeah. Because he essentially was young. He was, I think he was 39 when he was assassinated.
Oh, wow.
And he was also from a different ethnic group as well, which sort of changes that whole dynamic in the cabinet. And then in addition to that, he was also very popular. And actually, one of the things that that happened after Mboya was assassinated was Kenyatta actually went to Kisumu, which is like a major town on Lake Victoria, and his convoy was attacked because the big man that Njenga was talking about, some people sort of speculated that that was Kenyatta who kind of ordered for the assassination of Mboya. So this guy was actually executed, and he kept insisting that he wasn't acting on his own, that he had been ordered to take that particular action. And then the fact that he was Kikuyu also sort of kind made that even more, I'd say, difficult to make sense of. But yeah, there's a lot of these types of interactions between the government and other people in power and the different tribes, depending on your proximity to that particular power. Because after Kenyatta was president, Moi came into power, and Moi was from the Kalenjin tribe, which sort of feeds into post-election violence that I'm sure we're going to try to unpack a bit. Yeah.
So Mboya was Luo.
Yeah, Mboya was Luo.
Okay, because Barack's father as well was Luo. It's funny how you said Obama was part of the exchange program, because I think the author insinuated that probably Ali had a character in the book might also have been part of it, because he learned his profession about being a cryptic or something. Crypto analyst in abroad, and came back and was very still dissatisfied. And Obama in his book also talks about the fact that his dad came from how University of Hawaii graduate, then Harvard, and then he came back to Kenya to really do the good work, and he basically just died like a commoner kind of thing after the fight for independence. So there's definitely a whole big fat black hole in that way. And I guess the people that did the executioning for the Mau Mau massacre were kind of still alive to still do the whole oath of silence thing, and to still do a number of executions and a number of torturing to, like, the people that went against the government. That's why I said it's an irony that, you know, what the weapon that was used to fight for independence was also the same weapon that was used to fight for anti-independence. I don't know, after independence anyway. Mm-hmm. So that was just very interesting. But yeah, the 2007 riots, what was your experience of it like at that time? Was it as, not exaggerated, but was it as vivid as...
Yeah, because it was initially, like, there was confusion.
I think
I'd say the recurring theme, or the thing that we kept seeing quite a lot of, was confusion over what exactly was happening, because a lot of these, because I was also in uni at the time, a lot of these conversations, a lot of these actions that were being taken were very dramatic, I'd say. Like, people actually going onto the streets and protesting because, like, they kept saying that our vote has been stolen.
Yeah.
Then, because Kenya has had clashes associated with elections quite, like, since 1992, because that was when we changed from a one-party system to a multi-party system.
Yeah.
And then there was always like people who felt like aggrieved, and then it would essentially be taken out on people from certain communities because, again, of access to or perceived proximity to the community that's in power.
Yeah.
So because of that, because of the fact that it had happened before, I don't think people were very surprised. I think people were surprised mainly by just how long it lasted and how serious it got, like to the point where, like, there were stories of buses being stopped because they had rocks on a highway, and like buses being stopped and then people being asked to get off and show their IDs, because on your ID card it shows like the, even though for someone like me who's born in, who was born in Nairobi, my ID still says that my home area is Embu, for example. So you, if you look at someone's ID and then you look at where they were born or where it says they're from, it's easy to sort of deduce like what community they belong to. So people were being identified by things like those, even things like your name, which is a thing really interesting, because actually in the book, there's one of the Petrus, actually, his last name is Kea, which they said was a corruption of King's African Rifles. And that's why there's people named Kea from lots of different tribes. And that's something I didn't know. So there's that, the fact that this, in some instances, like it's really easy, or not, it's possible to identify where someone is from based on how they speak even, or like the kind of accent they have. But this was happening in Nairobi, which is like, one of the most like cosmopolitan places in Kenya, where there's lots of different tribes, lots of different people. But there, and then like the attacks were by like the Luo community against like the Kikuyu and Kalenjin, because the two previous presidents, or the president at the time and the one before him, were from the Kalenjin tribe. And one of things that that happened at that time as well was these types of exchanges where people were being told that there's people in our community who don't belong here, so they should be attacked, or like the property should be taken away, because a lot of the stuff that was happening at the ground level was like people attacking their neighbors because their neighbors were from a different tribe. So the way it played out really violently, especially in Nairobi, because there's a lot, there's a really big mix of communities and tribes and people from lots of different parts of the country. And as a result, what ended up happening was people being like literally identified by their neighbors, or their neighbors pointing them out and saying, this person is from this community.
Wow.
Yeah.
I wonder if there was any reconciliation done after that, like done in Rwanda, because whether I like it or no, you still go back to that same neighbor. After, I just wonder, was there anything done, or it was just more macro level? Sorry, everyone, let's move on.
Yeah, actually, if that was the overarching narrative, it was literally just accept what happened and let's move on.
Like, Ugochi, sorry, what did you?
The silence that everyone has been like grooved.
Yeah.
So a lot of the two main, actually it was four people were taken to the International Criminal Court and accused of crimes against humanity. And that was the future president and deputy president, and the guy who was the commissioner of police at the time, and a radio host. Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually had like a radio show, and what ended up happening was the way these conversations were, or the way the investigations were being done, was that someone, or like people would step up and testify about certain instances. And at this time, like, there were really big communities of internally displaced people, like people who were essentially pushed out of the communities or places that they had called home for years. And they had to go find new places to live. And So with time, the witnesses started to disappear to a point where, like, the case by the ICC sort of collapsed.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So one of the main things was that people were expecting for one of the reasons why the MPs in Parliament actually accepted a motion to take the suspects to the International Criminal Court was because the expectation was that Raila Odinga and Mwai Kibaki, who were the president and eventually the prime minister at the time, would be the ones taken to the ICC instead of the four people who were taken there. But what ended up happening was they just identified these four people and said these were the main actors. And then the expectation was that after the ICC process started, then we would have like the cases at like the smaller cases or like the instances where people were accusing their neighbors of doing certain things. The expectation was that the follow-up would be, let's have these cases in the country. But that didn't happen. So the ICC became the main focus, and then eventually the cases collapsed. And then after that, the two main suspects, the Uhuru Kenyatta and William Ruto, they came back to the country and said, we are from the two main tribes that were fighting during post-election violence, and we've come together to run in 2013 in the election, which was the first election after the post-election violence. And so we will run together. And that's how all that was just swept under the rug.
I just find it amazing. And I wanted, my first question is, how did you go from ICC suspects to running a whole country? Like that Kenyatta, your Kenyatta president. And then how do you go from being the son of the first Kenyatta guy who was also accused of so many things, Mboya and things like that, to again being president? And I realized I shouldn't be that shocked. This kind of things happen in Nigeria. Mm. So I don't know why I was shocked, but because I was going to say how? No how. Like, this is just the African way. I don't know if, you know, the people that vote, we just really don't vote because decisions are made on the top and we are just voting for voting sake, or if we are really forgiving, or if we are really ignorant of what's actually happening, that we don't factor these things when we vote. I don't know. Like, I don't even want to tell you to explain, because that's just it. Sorry, Ugochi, what did you want to say?
I think it's a mix of all three that you mentioned. I think propaganda also, and perception, it's easy to twist, right? Public perception to that. Because this Kenyatta who came back and said, oh, we fought against each other back then, but now we're coming back together. They probably still don't get along, but they've probably assembled this propaganda perception thing to change the minds of the people so that they can continue control. And I think that's what happens in a lot, not even African countries, in a lot of...
Just the powerful and the powerless.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask as well, I guess that's what's kind of happening to the royal family, like doing whatever to stay in power and to be perceived to be relevant. But Ugochi, I was going to ask, like, why do you think the author tied it up together? Like, she kept linking the independence to the 2007 riots. Like, what was that link? What was the interlinking those two events, would you say?
I wanted to highlight the transgenerational violence, how people might not really learn from the past if they don't talk about it.
Okay.
That's what I think. So I think that's why she linked all those things to show that, you know, the Mau Mau happened and these are the events that happened during that. And you see it again in the 2007 election riots where we have this violence again. And but you have their parents like Nipir just looking and saying, you know, like,
Nothing has changed.
Yeah.
That's why.
Okay, that's interesting. That nicely ties it up. Okay, guys, like, let's talk about the themes. Okay, so the water, there are just different themes. I'm just going to throw it out there. Keeping it short and sweet. what are your first thoughts when you think about water when reading Dust? Ugochi?
I think, so it was mentioned with ODD that he liked the water songs. see, I wrote down some quotes. He knew water songs that soothed. I think that he knew water songs to soothe his sister. Let's see, Isaiah's description of the Uganda house. The house paid homage to water.
I remember that.
Yeah, there's a water song that was sprinkled with life. Unshackled journeys, respite, rest. Drink, drink, flat-footed sand dreamer. So there's just a whole bunch of water references.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I thought that was an important theme. There was also, I think we'll get to it later on because I can't remember who says it. It might even be Galagu who says it or thinks it. When Ajani wants to cry at some point, but she's holding back her tears. So Galagu says, water, if you let down the tears, it will restore your life. So that's where I got water as restoring life, paying homage.
Soothing, yeah. That's very interesting. Eric, do you have any additions to, or is Ugochi the most like observant out of the three of us? Because I don't know.
Yeah, because I also noticed like there was a lot of references to water. Like, I think the fact that the place where where much of the story is set, which is in Turkana, is very dry.
And
there's I think the Lake Turkana is I think it's the biggest lake, biggest desert lake in the world. So you have like these two sort of put side by side, and the fact that Odidi also did work on dams, so he was kind of like a water engineer.
Yes,
and then also just the way like. Water is such a defining thing for the people in the story. Like sometimes they move to look for water, some other times they find themselves in situations where like they have this thirst, this continuous thirst, which is really serious. And then also, now that I mentioned lakes, the place, the house that Hugh lived in Naivasha, next to a lake, so there's a lot of random references to water, so it keeps coming up in very significant ways as like a background or backdrop for a lot of the action and a lot of the it becomes like a really big motivator for some of the actions as well. Like I think it was the construction of the house and the tanks as well, the way they kept mentioning that the tanks had water and then they cracked and then the water started seeping into the house.
Oh yeah,
it just keeps coming up like in these subtle like ways where you're like, oh okay, that's
I didn't pick up on that, but now you've said stuff about water, like we had a discussion previously and we're like, we don't understand the ending fully or remember that there was some kind of flood. And Ugochi, what you said really resonated, which is that maybe that new beginning that everybody was seeking at the end, new relationships formed and everyone just dispersing, maybe there was that need to bring in, again, the water body reference to show that, you know, this is kind of taking us to a new peaceful stage, which is what water has been used to kind of representing the whole book, where there's this need for water and it restores, it's a form of restoration. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
As you said, with the water tank and how it started to break when these characters started to come in and kind of open wounds.
Okay, so another term that, again, Ugochi discovered was birds, the reference to birds, and she also talked about vultures.
Yes. So I didn't pick up on the birds until Eric mentioned birds. Mine was just vultures and how vultures kind of wait for things to die so that they can come in and eat, right? So the first job that Neepir had, not the first job, but the one that he was, where he started to dig graves and bury those bodies when he was young, was called vulturing. So that's where mine went. And so there's a time in the book when Ajani in sorrow, she bites Galgalu because she's upset. So then the book says patient vultures watched over her, because that was a time when this was in the beginning of the book, when she felt not dead, maybe, but this is, she just came back from Brazil. She had stabbed her boyfriend, right? Her brother had just died and she just saw Galvalu. So she was just upset, you know, at a down place. And I mentioned that the vultures were there just waiting. And even when Akai gave birth and left her daughter under the tree. I think the book mentions the vultures were there, were there watching. So things like that.
There are also hyenas. So there's also like a bit of scavenging happening. Like after Akai gave birth and then she had to kill the camel. No, the camel died of thirst. And then she had to cut up like pieces of the camel and then try to feed her children. And then she left. And then when she tried to go back to the carcass, she saw hyenas. So that was something. Like there's always this looming presence of scavengers just waiting for like once like a death has happened, they just swoop in and try to, I'd say, take advantage of the situation. Yeah.
So the biggest theme of the book was silence. You know, I remember, I'm not really good at quotes, but I remember she said the three languages of Kenya is English, Swahili, and silence. That's all I remember. So it was quite big in the book. Eric, thanks for your Mau Mau narration. Like, I didn't even know that the oath of silence was started there in the book. It kind of made it seem like it was just a tool or a strategy for protesters to be silenced, people that were anti-government immediately after the independence. So I thought that started from there. But again, interesting that it was used for the opposite cause, pre-independence. But yeah, so the oath of silence, what was it? Was just more like people, sort of junior officers that kind of should know what's going on in the broad sense, being silenced for being taking an oath to silence them so that they don't kind of spread the news or the message of what's actually going on. And the repercussions for that was that a lot of atrocities took place, mostly people disappearing and nobody knowing, not even what happened to them, but if they even existed in the first place. I remember I was so stuck when Nipir was saying that literally the only reason you would know somebody was here is that maybe before his execution, they shouted, please, can you tell my daughter that I was here? And, you know, now I'm just, please tell her that. And that was their only, that was the only thing they were taking. That was the only thing they left behind, just that utterance. And that, and I found that very harrowing. So what did you guys make out of this theme that ran through the book?
Yeah, so I think the way the characters just interact, it's that if someone wanted information from someone else, the other person would just be quiet, like they'd refuse to speak. Like when Isaiah wanted to know what had happened to Hugh, even though he had like all of this evidence, like Odidi had sent him the book and the picture, so he knew. And then he saw like his father's books in the library, so he knew that this is somewhere that his father had been. And basically Nipir refused to talk to him.
And, yeah, I found that bizarre.
Yeah.
That it took 300 and something pages for him to just say, yeah, you know, your dad was a really terrible guy and I killed him, sorry.
Yeah.
And he wasn't really your dad anyway. Exactly. I just found it weird it took 300 and something pages of book.
Yeah.
So,
And then I think it's just the way, just the nature of life in that part of the country where there's really wide open spaces and then very few people. So it's just, it's like, it's almost land. Like you don't really have to feel, because I think for a lot of people, it feels awkward to just be in a situation where like there's no sound, there's no noise. But then for them, the main type of noise is the wind. So they have all of these secrets, and then it's like they're scared that if they start talking, I feel that if they started talking, they would end up revealing things that would probably incriminate them. So like every time someone is asked a question, like even when Ajani met, I think it was Odidi's girlfriend.
Justina.
Yeah. And she asked her, like, so what was your relationship? Is that his child? And then Justina also refused to talk. And all of these like interactions, I think initially are marked with silence. And then eventually it's like the, like you can't really keep quiet for that long. So you just start like telling the stories and then just, yeah, it's almost like the stories pour out of you after being quiet for that long. Yeah.
No, but just to say that, I don't know, the author, by the way, is brilliant. Like, and going on what you just said, it's funny how we all said, oh my God, this book is so boring. The first 150 pages, like, what the hell is happening? Why are you describing sand and dust? And there's a whole rush at the end where everyone speaks or everyone is more open or comfortable. And then it just ties up nicely. And I wonder if the author did that deliberately to just kind of really hone in on that silence thing and just that outburst that comes in the end. Ugochi, what did you think?
I want to ask you guys a question. Do you think that silence is metaphorical for death?
What do you mean? Like, expand, or what's going through your mind when you say that?
Okay, so there's this place where Ajani listens for whisperings that promise that she might live. So,
okay.
Ajani in the book, I think she was in Nairobi at this time walking around, and she said she's listening for whisperings that promise that she might live. Because everything was just silent. She was trying to get answers. Nobody was talking. So then I thought, is silence metaphorical for death?
So just more like when you're silent, really, you're dead inside. Is that what you're trying to say?
Yeah.
And it's only when you start speaking that there's some kind of
life,
hope or some kind of life. Yeah. Eric, Eric, and just going on, because I was going to say, what do you think of that? But even more importantly, like, do you think this behavior of what we saw in the book of the silence was learned? Like, is this, was it learned, do you think, because of that oath from the Mau Mau revolution? Or do you think it's just the way Kenyans behave?
But I think the way the oath worked was more like a manifestation of this almost like a national culture of silence and of like suppressing your thoughts or suppressing what you want to say. And at some level, I think that the way all of this sort of, it's like a pot that's boiling and boiling and boiling. And then eventually when you get to the end, that's when it's like overflowing. And the main trigger of this kind of overflowing is Odidi's killing, which is kind of I think kind of works with that, with the metaphor of silence being death. Because this particular death was a catalyst for the breaking of other silences, I think that was something quite significant. Yeah, so I kind of agree that silence in this case is a really clear, it's a clear metaphor for death and for the suppression of truth. And in that case I think just everyone trying to figure out what exactly is happening, and in the process like revealing all these other things that had happened in the background is kind of significant in that sense.
I think that fear also culminates or produces silence. So not only the oath, but the fear that surrounded all of the activity that was, the negative activity that was going on, brought about that silence. So when you say, is it Kenya? I think Nigeria has it too, with people who went through the Biafran War. I think a lot of them still have that fear in them, and they don't necessarily talk about what happened, and they don't necessarily want.
Is it fear or trauma though? Or can it be both? I just wonder, because again, following a lot of, you say Biafra, but I follow a lot of Biafra active supporters, and they are definitely not silent. They just, I don't know.
Young or?
Okay, yeah, they are young, so they didn't go through the war.
There's not many.
But for our parents, Sorry.
There's not many of the older ones that I see that are screaming, you know, let's do this again.
But that's why I'm saying, is it out of fear or out of trauma?
I think it's both, actually.
Yeah. It could be both, right?
Okay. Yeah. Because the way people respond to trauma is often like shutting down and like closing off the world, because you might find like a random trigger will take you back to that traumatic experience. Yeah. So
what you do, you compartmentalize and not refer to it.
Yeah.
Because you don't want, okay. Yeah. That makes sense. So many themes, but I don't think we can finish it. But just one more thing, like, what were the most profound relationships? So many, like, I have a whole list, but I think Ajani and Akema. I found, and I was telling Ugochi this, that I found it so bizarre that the author, throughout the whole book, you know, made us believe that she was adopted. Like, she was literally found, Ajani was found under a tree.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's because I didn't read it properly. As I said, the first 150 pages of the book, I was struggling to keep awake. But she made us believe that the poor child was adopted. She was found under a tree. And they kept referring to her features, that she was young. She was smallish. Her nose was bleeding a lot. So to me, she was always an outsider in the family, and I thought it's because maybe they found her on a tree. She doesn't really have a lot of background for us to go with as to why she has certain features or she behaves in this. And in the end, I was just shocked to say, wow, this woman came from Akaima, really? So I think the author really did a good job of trying to really exaggerate like the kind of relationship they had. Like, Akaima just did not send the girl. That means she just didn't like her. She ignored her. You know, she just reminded her of child loss. It also didn't help that in the book, Akaima lost a third child, like ODD, you know. So it brought up a lot of...
Also.
Sorry?
And her first two children.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So she lost a third child. So the first two children... And then ODD. So it didn't help at all. I think it's nice that in the end, they just understood, you know, we've never been close. You know, the author did a good job of also exaggerating like the touches at the end, like them touching each other. And there was a hug, or someone leaned their head on someone's shoulders. I don't know. But she really did a really good job. Like, she was like, this is all it's ever going to be. Like, I'm always going to value the fact that you've just touched me a bit. But like, we are just going to, go our separate ways, and I wish you well, kind of thing. But yeah, it was very, very stark, very difficult relationship. I just didn't believe that Ajani came from Akaima.
Now that you mention it, because she got, like, she had Ajani prematurely, and she basically like abandoned the child.
Yeah.
And then Odidi found her.
Yeah.
And then brought her to the house. And actually, that kind of explains the relationship of Odidi and Ajani.
Yes.
Odidi was always...
Yeah, he kept referring to her as my child. You're my child. Ugochi, sorry, what did you want to say?
What was I going to say? Why do you think that she was like that with her daughter, but not her son? Well, we don't really know how her son and her were, but we know that she grieved a lot for her son, right?
Come to think of it, she was really close to Odidi, like... I remember they used to describe that Ajani always used to walk behind, you know, because she was so afraid. But Odidi used to walk in front with the mom. Like, I don't know, it was just so bizarre. But coming to think of it, I don't know why, because now I'm thinking maybe she was close to Odidi because maybe she wasn't really grieving for Odidi himself as a person. Maybe she was grieving that this is an opened wound you guys have just opened and I've lost a third child. I don't know, but at the same time, it did seem that she was closer to Odidi than Ajani. I don't know why. I guess parents have their favorites. Because all the love she did not show for Ajani, the father took it on. You know, he was always like, Ajani, I need you. Even when she was in Brazil, you know, he kept saying, I need you. Can you come down? Your brother, this is what happened to your brother. When she was in Nairobi, like, he was always demanding for her presence. And I thought that was very nice. And that was like that was a lot of consolation, because I was like, this is so heartbreaking that your own mother... Again, I thought she was adopted at that point to the end. I was like, yeah, like, you know, the matriarch of the family is treating you this way. So when I kept realizing that, you know, the father just stepped in and was like, you know, was always referring to his daughter, I was like, this is nice. This is nice. Till at the end of the book, I learned that, oh, she's not even adopted. But yeah. Yeah. So thank you, guys. That's the theme. Let's go to favorite character. Again, list for ages. Ugochi, let's start from you.
Okay. My favorite character is Nipier. Even though he did some bad things, he started off as an orphan. His father and brother went to Burma to fight on behalf of the British. So he was left with his mom and his sister, but they ended up passing away. And so we also assume that his brother and father pass away because they don't come back. So
yeah. Oh, they might be living in Burma. Don't say that. You're killing Nipin's dream. In his 60s, he actually went to look for them. No. Keeping hope alive, I know.
He was left alone. So he came under the care of, I think, the Catholic mission. And so by the end of primary school, he was sent to another place where the priest thought he could earn some money. And that was all that was in his mind. I need to earn money to go to Burma.
To go to Burma. So simple. The objective was so simple.
It's so simple.
That's crazy. Yeah.
He just wanted to earn his money. He was lonely. But that loneliness created bad situations for him, I guess. It got him into bad situations. Where all he was thinking still was, I can earn extra money doing this because I need to go to Burma.
Bless him. I just like that in his old age, he said, right, I think I've saved enough. Bye. I'm going to Burma now. So peace out.
Yeah.
He was digging those graves and burying those bodies. He didn't know exactly what was going on. It sickened him, but he just kept thinking about the money.
To Burma,
he eventually started selling arms. But where I knew he had heart was when he killed Hugh for a kaima, because he was about to kill a kaima, right?
Yeah.
So he couldn't let that. So although he did some bad things, it was under stressful circumstances, and his main objective was to just see his dad and his brother again. So that makes him my favorite character.
Eric?
Mine was Ajani, because I feel like she, like, just looking at how close she was to Odidi, like, even to the point where, like, she tried calling him, like, just before he was killed, and the fact, like, she literally, like, dropped everything when she heard what happened, and she keeps going back and forth. And I feel like just her actions and her presence, that was a really big catalyst for a lot of the actions that happened in the story. Like how she met with Petrus, and she met with Isaiah, and she had that fight with Isaiah, and they kept, afterwards they made up. And that was,
And, oh my gosh, those two are funny.
Yeah, and even just the fact that a lot of the, like, her story is really tragic, because she was, like, her brother was doing really well in school, she wasn't doing very well, and she was very artistic, and she was also very sensitive as well, and just the fact that she could see something, and she could turn that thing that she sees into, like, a work of art, and even the way, like, the distance between her and her mother, like, back when she drew the creatures that they were describing in the stories, and how her mother responded, and even when I think it was Odidi who encouraged her, he told her, like, just keep doing what you're doing, and how, like, she kept like recalling all of the stories and all of the stuff that she and her brother did, including like accidentally discovering Hugh's remains. And then just the way she keeps like thinking back to her life in Brazil and mm-hmm. how she was in, I think it was an abusive relationship with was it Bernardo. Yeah.
That really resonated. Yeah.
And how in the end it just turned into a very, I'd say, her situation was really, really terrible, I'd say. And how she took Odidi's death really hard. Yeah. And it just shows like how close she was to her brother, like to the point where she was able to unravel, like she became, I felt like at some point she was the proxy of the reader. Like the story of Odidi literally being shot as he was trying to steal back his car. And then she went and unraveled that story. And then she was like, it was his partner at the engineering firm who stole his car. And yeah, so she became essentially like an extension. She was like the person.
Eyes.
That's the story. Yeah, exactly. She became our eyes. Yeah.
It seems like she was a storyteller of the book.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She learned about people's characters and what they did in her research.
Yeah, and just one last thing about Ajani as well. Like, it resonated with me because I think a lot of what we are exposed to as children kind of affects our relationship when we go older. So I just wonder going back to her relationship with Akema, that one person in life that should be on your side and really wasn't. And those kind of people, and then you correlate that with her relationship with Bernardo in Brazil, and if she was able to stay as long as she did, I don't know how long she did, either because of the oath of silence Kenya characteristics, I don't know, where she eventually stabbed him, or because she just had a difficult relationship with her mother and needed kind of validation from somebody she was willing to stay with, that beat her up, but she was willing to live with him till obviously she kind of like burst kind of thing. So I just wonder about that. The good thing about all these characters, especially the men like Newpeer, Hugh Bolton, Ali Hada and Petrus, is that it's sad. You watch their very complex history and how they started out strong, like Kenya, independence. And then you come to 2007 and they're just like, yeah, this is more complex than that. And we're kind of disappointed, but... yeah, I mean, it's sad. It's sad to see that kind of step down for everybody in terms of hope. What do you guys think? I've kind of said a lot.
I agree.
Yeah.
I wonder like how to move forward. Will this kind of thing happen again? Will another event happen again where people involved in like 2007 riot will look and say, wow, this is happening again, you know?
Yeah, and just to say, it reminds me of the NSARS. Obviously, NSARS is nothing compared to the 2007 riots. But again, being in the midst of it and really following it on social media and trying to be an online activist in quotes, but just following it, like I'm watching the expression of my mom. Obviously, being a civil servant and everything, she just looks at her like, I'm proud of these kids. I'm proud that they are stepping up and going out. But at the same time, I have my reservations because we've done this. We've heard it all before and we've done it all before. And, you know, it's just watching her and just that hopelessness of we've done it all before. I don't think it's going to get anywhere. And it really did happen that it didn't really get anywhere. Like for now, anyway, things are still developing. And it's just sad that generation, you know, of the 60s, 70s, they were the hippies of the world. Like, you know, baby boomer children, I think. The 70s era, the 80s era. And they're just saying that we've seen it all before. Like nothing, I don't know, especially in the African context. So yeah. Anyway, let's move on to Kenya. So the characteristics of Kenya. So as non-Kenyans, what we kind of picked out in terms of what we wouldn't really find in the Nigerian scene or in Nigerian in Nigerian books, not that we've read all the Nigerian books, but like what we found very interesting and we think is quite peculiar. Ugochi, do you want to start?
Yeah, mine is like the extreme description of things, like description of the land,
yeah,
the eyes of people, like descriptions that are nonverbal.
Mm-hmm. I picked up on a lot. The means of transportation was very interesting. Again, as I said, the first 150 pages of the book, I don't know where I was. I know I read stuff, but I remember seeing something about airplanes and airplanes landing in Turkana. Mm. But at the same time, people like the trader character and Akema were hustling and walking for days. And even Isaiah, they were walking for days to try and get to another village. And it was just so stark. Like, okay, there are airplanes that fly to these kind of arid regions, but I don't know, again, in Nigeria, it's kind of, there's kind of a middle ground where you just use rickety cars and there's just cars everywhere, as opposed to either going from extreme, like, especially the character Isaiah, like, the same character was walking for days to go to villages, but at the same time, he was in Nairobi chilling and, like, I think he was in the plane at one point. He had to use the plane to go back with Ali Hada. But I found that very fluid and extreme. Again, maybe I was reading it wrongly.
I understand what you're saying.
Okay. Yeah, right?
Yeah.
It's quite stark. It was just quite stark. So, Eric, do you want to react?
Yeah,
do you want to react?
To your perceptions,
you see what
we're
saying, though?
Yeah, I get what you're saying, yeah. Because I think one of the main things that the story brought out is just the vastness of everything. And because a lot of the like, having to walk long distances and having to, like, it's become easier to travel to some of these places, especially as links become, transport links become better. But yeah. A lot of the, like, it takes a really long time to get to some of the parts of northern Kenya. And I think that came out really well in the book. And then the other thing that I think you described is just how, I'd say, multifaceted Kenyans are. So, like, the person you are at home is different from the person you are at work. And then this kind of, like, shows up in the kind of language you use or in the kind of, I'd say, interactions and conversations you have. Mm-hmm. So, like, you can be, like, at the office speaking in, like, in English, and you can be out with your friends and you're speaking in Swahili, and then you can be home and then you're speaking in your mother tongue. So that's, like, you can really easily switch into these personas. Okay. Yeah, and that's something I think that came up really, really well in this book. And then I'd say another really interesting thing is that element of social mobility,
and yes, the fact
that you have kids from literally all walks of life who can go to, like, if you do really well, you can go to, like, a national school. So national schools are like the best secondary schools, and then from there you can even go, like, to an Ivy League university, even though you're from, like, a really poor background. And there's that element, there's the ability to move, like, yeah, from one level of society to another, just by applying yourself. But then you still have to play the game. You still have to find your way around the system, because the system is very deeply entrenched, to the point where, when I think it was when Odidi was asked, when his firm was asked to put silt in the dams and then open them, and then there was flooding further downstream, and his partners were like, you know what, let's do this, we're going to get money, and people actually died as a result of that action. And that was, like, the main catalyst for him. So he was coming from a system where he was adored, like, he had fans, he was a really prolific rugby player, and he was also he was literally, like, completely different from the person he was back in the north. But like that, the he somehow, like, ended up, like, falling back and getting into like being a violent gangster. And that sort of like harks back to the stuff that his father was doing. Like he was essentially running a gun smuggling program. Mm-hmm. But what ended up happening with Odidi sort of reflects just how difficult it is to like extricate yourself from your background or from your history, even though you're able to move like
wearing mask.
Yeah, exactly.
Wear the needed mask. And again, I didn't mention Odidi, but Odidi is part of the men that, you know, came from Ihai. As you said, he was basically, what do you call these people in school? He was a quarterback. He was a popular guy.
Yeah.
Came from that reputation, had a very good job, I can imagine.
Mm.
And then just fell, like hopelessness, that kind of hopelessness that he died on the side of the road.
Mm. And even when he ended up like moving in with a prostitute.
A prostitute. A happy prostitute that was just living her life. I like her.
And how like she ended up helping him like avoid police roadblocks by giving him disguises. And that was really interesting. That was a very weird shift. Because you'd expect that someone who's doing really well or someone who's excelling to that extent would at least try to maintain that the level of success that he had achieved. But essentially, he threw all of that away on principle.
Okay, so we're coming to the end. You guys, where do you think the name Dust came from?
I think just from the setting of where Worth Ogik is, which is a semi-arid area, and the fact that water wasn't always available, and then they didn't have that much vegetation, so anytime there was wind, there'd be all that dust that was in the air, and just the fact that if you think about it, dust is really like it's everywhere and it finds a way into everything. So I think the way, like if you look back at how the violence in this particular story keeps repeating itself and it keeps appearing, it feels very like omnipresent. And I think it's sort of like metaphor. It's not literal. It's figurative and it's literal as well. There's a dust in the desert, and then there's just the fact that all of these people were somewhat like dirty in a certain way, like they were all tainted by their reputations.
And I think the irony, we've been talking about water, that she goes to name the book a complete opposite. Ugochi, what do you think about the name?
So at first I thought, you know, like from dust it comes out, from dust it will return. So they built... Hugh built the house from dust.
Yeah.
And then it culminated something. And then at the end, the house was burned down. So that's what I got from dust. But hearing you, Eric, say the dirtiness of things.
That's deep. That's profound. I thought, I thought it was more about, again, that culture of silence. I don't know, this fluidity, I'm so fixated on it. And the fact that the characters could go in and out, like the war was, this thing, what was more profound was people like Ali Hada, you know, he had a life in Nairobi and then he disappeared to the north and then he could just disappear like that. And Akema as well, Nipir as well, you know, came to Worth Ogik and established a whole life. You don't really know where he came from, where he went to reach there. And it's just the fact that they could appear and disappear. What was key for me were those people that died, those people that were tortured, you know, the fact that their identity could literally be, could vanish. You don't even know if they existed, like dust. So that was very interesting for me. That's why I thought the wedding name. But I also agree with what you guys said, we've come to the end. Hey, yes. Okay, Ugochi, final thoughts, your beautiful quotes that you always bring out, please.
I'm so fascinated by the way her description in the book of everything. So she says, this is in regards to Ajani when she was crying. I think I mentioned this earlier. She was crying over Odidi's grave and because Petrus had just given a prayer.
Mm. Yeah.
Started crying, it was dry tears also. So Gagulu was there and he was thinking and he says, tears are rain, they water soil, restore life. So that was my favorite quote in that context.
Mm.
Yeah,
I guess sure. The whole book is full of good poems and good quotes. Eric, do you have any?
Yeah, so I think my favorite quote is the one about kind of having three languages, English, ooh, Swahili, yeah, and silence. That was, yeah, that was really significant. And then also just picking up on the poeticness of it, just the fact that she can pack so much,
yeah,
so much meaning and so much so much content into like a very like one paragraph. And then like so much will happen in one paragraph. And then the way the sentence is also constructed. So you have like one really long, really like windy sentence. And then sentence after that is just like two words.
Full stop. Yeah.
It's like, yeah, the pacing alternates like really wildly. And then that sort of like maintains like the kind of rhythm and the kind of flow that you'd find in a poem. So that was really significant as well for me.
Yeah, it was good. I couldn't believe. I remember those early pages. I kept calling Ugochi. I was like, let's change this book. I can't do it. You guys think it's an exaggeration. But you must remember, like, I was like, yeah, let's change the book. And then things took off. I think when Ajani reached Nairobi, it got better. And it just kept getting better. But my God, like, she did a brilliant job. And I'm never ashamed to admit when I was wrong. But yeah, it was a really good book.
When I updated my Goodreads that I'd finished this book and I gave it a rating, someone actually responded to that tweet and said, finally, someone else who's finished the book. So I was like, yeah, it's not...
It's not an easy read.
It's not an easy read, but it's a very rewarding read, especially how everything just comes together in the end.
I feel like I've been schooled on Kenya. I think I can actually go to a table and I'll be like, the Mama Revolution. I think I can.
You can hold your own, yeah.
Yeah, I can. Mm. Yeah. Mm. So I'm really happy we did this. And yeah, we've come to the end, guys.
Yeah, so please like, share, subscribe. We very much appreciate it. Follow us on our Instagram page, our Twitter page, and our Facebook group, AfroReads Podcast. Our next book that we'll be reading is called Nervous Conditions by Titi Dangaremba, but she is from Zimbabwe. So we're going to Zimbabwe to read her book, and we're very excited about that. Before we sign off, Eric, is there anything that you want to plug or share your social media handles?
Or give a word of advice to our listeners.
Okay. So I'd say by way of advice, just support African authors and find their work and buy it. And just make sure that if you have a bookshelf, it has to have as much African literature as possible. So I am at Mugendi, Mugendi, on Twitter and Instagram. And I'm Eric Mugendi on Facebook. And yeah, those are my social media handles, I guess. Yeah.
Great. We'll definitely post those links in the description. And also, listeners, don't be shy to participate in discussion on our social media handles. We would love to learn from you. We want to create a space where we learn from each other about African history and African issues and African talk. So until next time, take absolute care of yourselves and see you soon on our next episode.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.